Hello, Whiteline Wireless listeners. Anth here, just with a little note before we get into the podcast. As you're listening to my podcasts, anything that I have written down, so stuff that's backed up on the website with all its sources, you can be pretty confident that I'm getting that right. However, one of the things I'm trying to do with this podcast is to take my guests off onto tangents to have interesting conversations around things that I haven't researched beforehand. When I do this, I do have a tendency to get things wrong from time to time. In the past, I've sometimes jumped in and edited the podcast, and other times I've just let things slide. However, in a new experiment, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put any corrections that I notice that I need to make during the editing process into the description of the podcast. So, for example, I've got a few things in here about the Australian Open and whether or not nurses are in the AIF itself, and some things about sports photography and Australian colours. I get some of those things wrong, or I offer a little bit of clarifying detail in the notes. So if you have a look at that, you can get a little bit more information. Thanks for listening. Here's the show.
DNA. So when they start to play and you want to know and you can't find the call on the radio, go the White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
Just one click to hear it all.
Boba, boba, bloody bo.
Hello and welcome to Whiteline Wireless's telling of the AIF 11 tour. I'm Anthony Condon and joining me again this week is Supun Ambapitiya. Supun, how are you going?
I'm going really well, Anthony.
That's great to hear. So we spoke about Scotland last week. This week we have two matches against Durham and Leicestershire. So just for those of you who might be jumping in for the first time, again, to remind you, please go and check out my website, anthonycondon.com, where you'll find all of these tour diaries written up with all of the sources that pop up in front of you that I have reconstructed them from. So in case you are not aware, these are all made up by me, but reconstructed from real sources where you can click through and read other reading 100-year-old match reports and that kind of thing, if that's your bag. And also, you know, lots of pictures and that kind of thing as well. So this is part of my PhD thesis. If you really want to get the full in-depth of what's going on, the introductory episode and episode zero will really set you up. So we are going to jump straight into Cow Corner this week. We've got a few different things to talk about, but we will kick off with the cricket. As I was saying, we've got Durham and Leicestershire. So we're playing at Park Drive in West Hartlepool and at Alston Road in Leicester. So Cow Corner. We had a cushy week this week, only playing the two days games against Durham and Leicestershire. Both games were draws with little to note beyond the three first-rate performances in the first day at Alston Road. Our batsmen gave the home bowling a rare toweling, chief amongst the batting being the centuries by Nip Pellow at 187, Carl Willis with 156, and Herbie Collins with 121.
Oh, Collins again, just being a good captain.
Just knocking them out, yep. Most of the Leicester 11 were from pre-war days. Seven in the side remembered meeting Sid Gregory's team of youngsters in 1912. Indeed, Samuel Coe can remember his match as a young man against the Australians in 1896. So Sam Coe's been playing at first class level for 23 years.
Now. Yeah. And there seems to be quite an older side.
Really, yep. Yeah. So the Leicester side, yep, yeah, were largely the old guys. And as we've mentioned, had several conversations about whether teams chose to play youngsters or the legends or a mix. But Leicester were definitely one of playing the old ones. That's actually all Cow Corner's got to talk about with the cricket this week. We've got some other stories to have a look at. So we'll jump over to the scorecards early and tell you about those two two-day matches
Actually, that's the first thing that's worth mentioning. Yep. I had 3 days off this week.
Oh,
I think that's,
they would have spent their time in the English pubs drinking warm beer.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. A few teetotalers on the team, so not all of them would have, but a few very not teetotalers on the team as well.
And the Australian cricket team, whichever form is taken, has always been proud of the fact that it can outdrink any other cricket team in the world.
It does have a long tradition.
Merv Hughes has the record for the most number of VBs drunk from a Sydney to London flight, I think it was.
David Boone. Yep, you're getting your bearded fat men mixed up, but your mustachioed fat men mixed up. But it is the Tasmanian great David Boone who. Yeah, maybe the ARF 11 could have used Boonie last week in Scotland to understand the light of those latitudes. Actually, in the podcast feed that you are listening to this on at the moment, if you're not listening to it on the website, if you go back probably 2 years or so now, actually there's a podcast on alcohol in Australian cricket where we go into, we do a full
bit of a deep dive, drinking from the well.
Because alcohol is intricately connected to Australian cricket. It paid for the game to start. That's the reason why England came here originally. So, without alcohol, without Felix and Spears, who were looking for a way to promote their establishment, we wouldn't have had the first English cricket team out here. Funny story, got the English cricket team out here because Charles Dickens refused to come out for a speaking tour. So he was like, no, I've just been to America and I'm never going to another colony.
Look, fair enough.
So Durham versus the Australian Imperial Forces. AIF win the toss, decide to bat. How'd the game go, Sapun?
Like most of these two-day games, drawn.
Drawn.
And so Australian batted first, couple of standouts. Collins 49, but run out. So I believe
wouldn't have been Gregory this time.
No, not Gregory this time. It would be Trenery at fault here.
Yep.
But J.M. Taylor, a bit further down the order, also run out. So they could have run each other out. Don't know. We don't know the exact order there.
Say that would have that to me. Having a look at that, we don't actually know exactly when which wicket fell when. But I reckon that Trenery has. I reckon Trenery's run out Collins because I reckon that's would have been Sterling first to go. Then Trenery has run out Collins and then run out Taylor.
Yes, I can see that working
in the space of an over by the look of it. So. Yeah, shouts on him tonight.
Yeah, but Australia managed to get to 354 runs in the first innings.
Yeah, Palu getting a handy 63. Yep.
And then they sent Durham into bat. So now just a couple of mentions in the Durham bowling first. Milam, 4 wickets, 100 runs, 6 maidens, 36 overs. Smith, 3 wickets, 99 runs, 5 maidens, 30.4 overs. So very even bowling talent.
And there were another 3 bowlers that bowled, but they only had 26 overs between them. So this is a great example of that late 19th century, early 20th century style of play of just having 2 guys end to end.
Do the work.
All day.
Do the work. Just your workhorses.
Yeah.
So Durham, in reply, did manage to get to 269 in their first innings, which is a reasonable effort.
Largely on the back of Thomas Kinch.
Yes, who got himself 105 runs. Yep. But then they got themselves bowled out at 269, and then Australia went to have a bat again and got themselves to 336. And no run-outs this time.
8 for 336.
For 336.
But again, no century in that score over 300. So becoming quite a feature of the Australian play. We've got Murray, Palu and Willis all getting to 50 or more, with Murray top scoring on 86. And Collins out for 47. So really everyone has shared the efforts there.
And just a couple of things to note here. Palu, Collins, Trenery and Gregory were all out caught and bowled. two to Millam, one to Doggart, and one to Smith. And I'm assuming
that's extraordinary.
Spin bowling wasn't too much of a thing in these days.
No, absolutely. Yep. So this is the it would have been I say slow bowling was definitely a thing.
Yeah.
So spin bowling. So we do have.
Did there be a couple of like off breaks or? So
this is the first days of googly bowling.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of people around who can do it. Lampard can, and he's quite good at it. He took a 9 for. In the Lancashire
game.
Yeah,
I think I remember yeah. listening to that game.
Yeah, 9 for 42 when so playing on a sticky wicket and just got those bozies to turn sideways. But amongst the yeah, it still wasn't a huge thing. It's been around about sort of 15 years at this stage and
hasn't really had a chance to grow and become the deadly weapon we know it as now.
Yeah, yeah, and we talk about this in one of the early episodes. It's Vogler, I believe, or Pegler. I think it's Vogler. I had to edit that podcast because I got that name wrong. So if you've been listening week by week, you might remember that. Yeah, the South African heads over, plays with Bosanquet, Bert of Bosanquet, who's the inventor of the googly, but couldn't land it. He was really, really inaccurate. And Vogler takes it back to South Africa. South Africa's all learn how to do it and how to land it and land it accurately. And that's why South Africa are able to beat England for the first time, basically, you know, playing four googly bowlers who can all land it and turn it both ways. So, a lot of slow bowling, a lot of medium pace. The underarm's pretty much all gone by this stage, yep. though. Yeah. Again, Australia in the second innings. Yeah, just Willis with the 57. That would have been an easy win to the Australians, but had to be drawn.
Because it's a two-day game.
It's a two-day game, like the game in Leicestershire, which again was a drawn. So this is the AIF win the toss and decide to go in and have a bat.
And they batted for the entire day. So Collins 121, Pelu 187, Willis 156, 551 declared at the end of day one.
So for the loss of five wickets, have a look at the Leicestershire bowling where they have
four bowlers eight. Almost conceded 100 runs each. Geary and King 103 and 114 runs conceded. And they brought another four people in to bowl because, like, something's got to work.
Yeah, and it didn't. No. Yeah, it didn't. So they bowled the whole team, just about eight bowlers, and no one really able to have any sort of impact. So come out the next morning, second day of the game, Leicestershire have, and they're like, well, we've got to chase 550.
And they tried. There's a couple of 50s in there. Whitehead got 58. Coe got 53.
And, you know, remember Coe's like 400 years old at this point. I think I should be able to get his date of birth up here. So, yeah, born in 1873. So what that makes him 37 plus 19, 56.
Yep.
He's 56 years old. And
he scored a 53.
Yeah, 53 against a not inconsiderable bowling force with Collins and Gregory and Sterling and Lampard. So, yeah, facing four tough bowlers at 53 years old. So I think that deserves it. That definitely deserves a shout out, that one.
And then Leicestershire all out for 224. And there's obviously just enough time of the day for Australia to go out and bat again.
Yeah.
And they send out Murray and Ball, who make 28 runs in 14 overs, and the game is drawn.
They didn't make Leicestershire follow on. And that's interesting because it's you usually enforce the follow-on at this stage, but there must have been, you know, 30 minutes left. Yep. And they said, oh, let's see what we can do, but then scored a rate of two and over.
Yeah.
What are you doing, guys?
They could have done anything and it wouldn't have mattered because it would have been it's going to be a draw anyway.
I mean, they got 14 overs in. You never know. They could have ripped through them in 14 overs. Like, I would have... I'm not 100% sure what Collins was thinking on that one. It was a slow week.
And, like, Collins didn't even put himself into bat first.
No. Nah.
But to be fair, he had spent, what is it, 30 overs bowling and getting 3 wickets.
He's put in Murray and Bull, so he put in a bowler. So that's the Leicestershire game. So a pretty insignificant week of cricket. But that's okay, because Cow Corner has some other things to tell us about, because there was a couple of other interesting sporting events going on. So let's let Cow Corner tell us about it. There is plenty of other sporting news coming out of Europe and the home country this week. It is not just cricket. There is a great revival in all forms of sport. Perhaps the greatest event of the tennis world, certainly the greatest of the British Empire tennis, is the annual fixture at Wimbledon. The resumption of the championship meeting has excited enormous interest among the sport-loving fraternity. 5 AIF men were amongst the 128 entrants in the singles, including the winner, Captain Gerald Patterson, MC. Being too young to obtain a commission here when he went off to the front in late 1915, Patterson joined the English Army and went on to serve as a captain with the Royal Field Artillery, gaining honours in the greater game, being awarded the Military Cross. Patterson was a practically unknown quantity in England at the commencement of the season, but had come to the front in Melbourne before the war called him away, when he ran up to O'Hara Wood in the Australasian Singles Championship and won the doubles with Ashley Campbell. So he won the 1914 Australasian doubles and finaled in the singles.
I assume they weren't as prestigious as Wimbledon or as the Australian Open itself. I'm not sure if the Australian Open was around yet.
I have a feeling this is what just becomes the Australian Open, and it's a... I don't know when it becomes Grand Slam. It's quite early. I'm pretty sure it's by the 20s that it's part of the...
the Grand Slam circuit.
And yep. But it was really highly regarded because Australia was the best country in the world at tennis.
Yep.
America, England, there were some Frenchmen, but yeah, Australia really dominant. And this is actually, this is interesting to read, because so there's 5 Australians out of 128 entrants in the singles. And the other thing that's worth mentioning here, so Patterson has won the knockout rounds.
Yes.
So the way Wimbledon used to work is if you won Wimbledon, you only had to play one game the next year. So the whole tournament went through, and the person who won that tournament played last year's winner. And that's called the challenge round. So Patterson accomplished a fine feat in reaching the challenge round with the loss of only one set. So he's gone through from 128 down to 1 and losing one set. In the challenge round, he met the present champion of the world on grass courts, Norman Brooks, whom, although did not serve in the AIF, was a Red Cross commissioner in Egypt, France, or Mesopotamia.
One of the three.
He definitely was AIF commissioner in Egypt. I definitely know that. But I have another quote where it's like France or Egypt, France, Mesopotamia, but definitely in Egypt. For almost the whole of the 5 years, it was before I go back to Cow Corner, so he's in the Red Cross, and it's worth pointing here that people who served in the Red Cross were not eligible for our cricket team.
Oh.
Yep. So it's a Red Cross and the Comforts Fund. You had to be in the AIF to do that. So there are two Australians in the final of Wimbledon, in the men's singles final. Both of them served in the war, but neither of them were AIF.
Yep.
So it's, interesting. So he's gotten through Patterson and Brooks in the final. So this is about Brooks. For almost the whole of the 5 years, it was a rare thing for him to touch a tennis racket. And if he did, it was for him merely whiling away a pleasant hour of relaxation against some player who could scarcely win a stroke. Brooks' lack of match practice was evident, being easily beaten by Patterson 6-3, 7-5, 6-2. Patterson is also the nephew of Dame Melba. What a grateful tonic to a war-weary nation that family is providing.
That's not something I was expecting.
Yeah. So it's second time Dame Nelly has come up in this series, which is not surprising. She is one of the biggest names in the world at the time. You know, she's the 1919 Taylor Swift or the like.
Maybe more 1919 Madonna than Taylor Swift.
Oh, she's not very old.
Okay. 1919 version of the 1980s Madonna.
Yeah, quite possibly. Quite possibly. She was wasn't afraid of controversy, the old dame. Yes, and then we've got a bit more on Cow Corner and tennis. So the doubles final was also an all-Australian event. Pat O'Hara Wood and Ronald Thomas went down to Rodney Heath and Randolph Lysette, 3-1. Lysette was also the mixed doubles champion. He and American Elizabeth Ryan teamed up, as they say over there, to defeat the British pair of Albert Preble and Dorothea Lambert Chambers. This means the only events at the World's Championship on grass not won by an AIF man were the women's singles and doubles.
Well, yes, because the AIF... Did the AIF have any women's in the actual...
No, women. No.
So not even in support roles. So.
No, because it's nursing. The nursing corps is separate I believe. Like, yeah, their records aren't in the same place I look for the men's records. So
the AIF could not have submitted a candidate for the women's singles or doubles.
No. So, but also he's wrong there because the other two in the singles weren't AIF. They were Red Cross and BEF. So I might edit that. special mention though must go to Lily Addison, who although lost her second round singles match, made it to the fifth round in the mixed doubles. Miss Addison served as a nurse in Egypt, Palestine, and Salonika. A reminder that even though it was the boys who faced the iron thrust on the Western Front, the womanhood of Australia had rallied to the call for service with an alacrity equal to that of the men.
Alacrity. Great word.
Yes. Really, as I was saying before we went into this, Australia was quite the dominant nation at tennis, and they absolutely dominated there. But what I want to show you, and this is worth jumping onto the website, I reckon, listeners, and have a look at the picture I've got there of Dorothea Lambert Chambers.
She's wearing a dress. She's wearing a full length dress.
I mean, it's what you expect to see a women tennis player wearing in. I'm not 100% sure when this is. She plays from like 1910 through to the mid 30s or so. And it's Dorothea Douglas by this stage. This is after she got married. So this is after the war, I imagine. But the reason why I really wanted to highlight it is just how amazing a sports photograph it is. It's one of the things that, because I'm interested in photography as well, and so we get this, at this period we're starting to get all this great, amazing sports photography, and there's this lovely incongruity in this photo between the amount, like say, the photographer has done a really good job here of capturing the pace and the motion of the shot she's playing, the focus and determination on the face, and then just this absolutely ridiculous dress. And I think it's just a great sporting photo.
It's hard to imagine how she actually managed to move across the court, because this dress goes down to her ankles. Mm. Like it is, and it's got a number of layers to it as well by the look of it. So she'd be tripping and she'd be sweating like crazy in this dress.
Yeah, there's definitely petticoats going on there. Yeah. I did find a great quote. I can't remember exactly. It might have even been her. But a female tennis player at this stage, and it might have been a male tennis player, and they were injured, like couldn't use one of their legs. And they were saying, oh, it's grass court. You don't have to move anyway. They're saying, you know, on the clay court, on the hard courts, you do have to run around. But on the grass courts at this stage, there wasn't a lot you could make the ball do. There wasn't a lot of, and you couldn't really get to the angles like they can today. So it really was kind of, you know, he stood in the middle of the court and just went left and right. So, Yeah, and because another thing that's worth heading to the website and having a look at a lot of the photos of the cricketers that I've got is I've really tried to use George Beldon's photos where I can. And he's the guy who invents cricket photography for all intents and purposes, invents sports photography, really. There'd been the guy before him in the late 19th century who had – have you seen the photos of the first time a horse running was photographed?
Yes, yes.
So all paintings of horses before like 1870, 1880, there's always one foot on the ground.
Yep.
Because it's not until that time they realised that all 4 feet came off. Until they took those photos. So there's that guy who took a lot of photos of naked boys playing and for science. But then George Beldon comes along and he takes the trumpet shot. And if you've ever seen a photo of Victor Trumpy, you'll know the shot I'm talking about. Gideon Hay's written a whole book about it. He went out and stood on the ground during cricket matches to take photos, and otherwise all your photos are just some guy standing there with a bat. He sort of went out, stood at a short square leg position and took photos.
Well, they didn't have the zoom lenses that we have nowadays.
No, absolutely no zoom lenses. And just to be able to get the quality of the film at that point, you would need a lot of light to be getting action shots, so they're really I love them. I must say it's one of my favorite things about researching this period is George Beldon's photography, and really invented a lot of the vernacular of cricket photography that we see today. And I think you can see that. So if you're into photography, go and have a look at that. But for now, we will jump back to Cow Corner. Australian athletes figured conspicuously in the Inter-Allied Games, which were concluded at Paris last week in the presence of thousands of interested spectators. Unlike the cricket and tennis players, the Australian successes at the Games were not many, insofar as their capture of prizes were concerned, but they became the most popular group of the competing nations. When the AIF team appeared at the opening ceremony, clad in their blue and gold, there was a great cry of Les Australiens, vive les Australiens, and their greeting by the French populace was second only to that accorded to the athletes of France. This is a timely reminder that this war was not just fought for the empire and the country's safety, but to make the world secure for freedom and democracy.
So blue and gold.
Blue and gold, yes.
So the gold has been the Australian colour for quite some time.
Yeah.
I assume the blue was there to represent Mother England?
I think it sort of went with the sea, maybe. Yeah. So I think green and gold becomes the official colours of Australia in the 80s. Because by that time that had been going on long enough. But it's by the 20s it's sort of all green and gold. This would have been probably one of the last of the blue and gold. Yeah. I mean, you still see a lot of blue and gold, but there's always green in it as well. It was really the cricketers who sort of did the green and gold, the baggy green, and it's something I've mentioned in this podcast as well, but I don't know if you know, the crest on the baggy green is not the Australian coat of arms, it's the Australian cricket coat of arms. They're older than the Australian coat of arms because they're older than Australia. It's not the states in the middle, it's the ship and the sheaf of wheat and the miner's pick, and the ship, sheaf of wheat, miner's pick. And the sheep.
Yep.
Are in there. Blue and gold, which was the uniforms at that stage. I don't know how much we can trust the Australian reporters here saying that they were the most popular.
There has been a soft spot within France for the Australian Armed Forces.
There is quite
a large Anzac Day celebration or commemoration every year in France, especially along the Somme.
Yeah. And this is sort of part of the reason why I included it in this is to, it is so much of what becomes Australian identity, Australian national identity, comes out of this period. I was talking to a friend about it the other day, and you've got to remember every single town sent someone.
Yep.
You know, it's something like 25% of the male population went to the war. So every single town sent someone, and they all went over, and they
There's a plaque in every single town today of the names of the people they sent.
Exactly. You know, like my town of 3,000 people, and we've got 3 Victoria Cross winners in it. You know, that's kind of what we've got statues and everything for it. The town's quite proud of it. But like I was saying last week, how we're talking about all the guys in the one division. Highlights this point I'm trying to make here about you have these guys from all over the country come together and they all get put together and there is a lot of swapping around. And so things like slang and attitudes and stuff really
mix
from what was a very disparate population where, you know, the culture in Sydney would have been was very different than the culture in Melbourne. You know, Sydney was very much more much more Anglican, you know, as Melbourne was. So Sydney is kind of like the lots of convicts and Protestants. Melbourne, you know, it's lots of Catholics. Adelaide, it's all free settlers. They've got very, very different cultures going on there. You know, like in Adelaide, until the First War, you could still get away with speaking German. And they all get pulled from every town. They get put into this tiny little, you know, into this group close together. And then put through this really extreme experience. For example, it's a great read. You can find it through one of the links. But if you just look on the Trove website for Digger Dialects, it's a book of World War One slang, and it's quite hilarious to read. They're quite. It's probably the funny, like the Australian slang from 1919 is probably the funniest thing I've read from the period. It is like the stuff in there that is genuinely funny still, whereas most jokes you read from, you know.
There's just too much that doesn't flow through. There's too much that requires context. Like the comedies in Shakespeare and the in-jokes in Shakespeare, you won't understand unless you spent a good 3 years reading about the history or the politics of that era.
Well, and at least there's like genuine proper dick jokes and stuff in like lots and lots of dick jokes in Shakespeare. It's, you know, 90% dick jokes. But, you know, whereas by like the Victorian, because this isn't Victorian era, it's post-Victorian, but you know, that second half of the 19th century, the Victorian age is probably the most repressed period in history, just about, you know, as all of these Englishmen force themselves to have this amazing, you know, this high moral standard, so they can convince themselves that they were better than all of the people that they were colonizing, and so the humor from the period really, really does miss a lot, But the slang is genuinely funny, and worth a read. So the point being that this is, it really explains why so much of what Australian identity gets linked to things, you know, the egalitarianism, this idea of mateship, and stuff like that, the blending of sport and war, and this militarization of sport, the Australian identity, the image Australians like to think overseas people have of Australians as being, you know, these giant supermen, you know, comes from the First World War, when the first lot of soldiers who were sent over there were all over 6 foot. So they genuinely, like, it was the first impression a lot of people had of Australians were that they were massive and giants. And so a lot of it comes out of that. And I like last week and this week with those guys traveling together and this week with all these sports going on, really sort of shows why those attitudes come out. That's right. We were talking about why the French found them popular, and I reckon that's because a big part of the Australian identity in the war was this absolute abhorrence of class structure.
Yeah.
And so most of the Australians would have just been out, you know, bloody drunken yobboing when they met the Frenchmen, and they would have been French yobbos as well. Look, these peasant farmers and stuff like that that you're coming across at the time, and it would have been good to have a drink together. Yeah. There's a story that I haven't included that happens around this time when they're talking about fishing in, like, dynamite fishing in France.
as in literally using dynamite to kill fish and
it became a big thing. Okay. So that's the end of this week. A big Wimbledon. And the Inter-Allied Games are worth explaining a little bit as well, probably. The Inter-Allied Games was because there was supposed to be an Olympics in Paris in 1920, I believe. And so they had this together. And like the Americans built, it's one of the first concrete stadiums. And they built a 20,000-seat stadium in under 6 weeks.
That is a lot of concrete.
So, you know, it was really, the Americans were really like, we're going to show you how we do. Because this is really like America's coming out party as well to the world. They were very isolationist before this. And then, yeah, they had these inter-allied games. And so there was 10 nations, all the allies. And because they were sort of like, oh, should we have an Olympics again? And they're like, yeah, but we're not going to invite Germany.
Yeah. Germany. No, you can't invite Germany.
Yeah, they weren't going to get invited to the Olympics again. But that sort of eventually did as people went, maybe we need to reintegrate them. So the people at the Olympics saw the problems with the Versailles Treaty, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, the they played. So there's you can see photos from the Inter-Allied Games of the American national rugby team playing and there's lots of swimming world records that were broken at it. So yeah, it's an interesting period. Worth having a look into if you're interested in the history of athletics. It's one of the more notable events that you don't come across too much. But that's all we've got from Cow Corner this week. So, Poon, anything you'd like to reflect on, chat about?
I never really realised Australia was so dominant in tennis. Like, because nowadays we hold the Australian Open every year, but it doesn't really. It's only very rare that an Australian will get through to the finals either side, the men's or women's.
We're actually recording this the day after. So Ash Barty's just won the French Open. That's the first time in like 60 years or something an Australian's won the French Open. But yeah, Australians tended to win the French Open at one point in time.
Yeah. So it's all it's interesting, and I'm not sure whether it would be our decline in the skill level of tennis or just everyone else increasing their skill level. Or a bit of both.
It's both. It's both. So it's definitely a decline in popularity. So you go to the 1930s, for example, and the big sports in Australia were the footballs, depending on what state you're in, cricket, tennis, hockey.
Yep.
And swimming. So that's the and tennis and hockey, they were like the big women's games, and so a lot of the strength in tennis came from like that's what people did in the summer was they played tennis and then, hockey in the winter, I think. But, Australia was quite dominant for a really long time, and it's why you get this anachronism of being one of the Grand Slams because it's England, France, US and Australia because they were the only four countries that meant anything in tennis in the 1920s. That's someone from not one of those countries winning a Grand Slam or winning a major was quite unheard of. The other thing is that tennis at this stage is still professional amateur.
Yeah.
So Wimbledon is an amateur competition. So the other thing is that I think it's especially with Americans, we're much more likely to become professionals because there was a really big professional circuit in America, just the size to support it, whereas Australians tended to remain amateur a lot more, and so I think that might have something to do with it.
I do want more amateur sports to come back in to vogue, like especially at the Olympics. Like, let countries, like especially like if you don't, you might not like Jamaican bobsled team as an example. Like, let's have if you're a country and you want to submit a team, let's just have them play regardless of the skill level. Don't make them be the best. At the World Championships or in the top 10 at the World Championships to qualify. We've never had a weightlifting team before. Doesn't matter. We're sending this guy in. Yep. Yes, we know he only weighs 80 kilos and we're asking him to lift 200. Doesn't matter. Like
well, they do have – there is that in – so like the 100 I think it's the 100 meter freestyle.
Yeah.
I think they have like, you know, 40 bloody heats of that because
everyone just does
you
it. Can, yeah.
If you're the only person from your country, yeah. you get in. Although I think now they've actually
I think 2000 Olympics was the last time they sort of did that, and then now you have to
Eddie the Eel or whatever it was. Yeah, that dude who took 2 minutes or something to swim the 100. Yeah.
So you either have to be qualified a certain ranking in the world rankings, yeah. Regardless of which country you're from, or you have to hit a minimum time. Or a minimum score depending on the sport. But it's just,
well, you lose the stories.
Yeah. And then every now and then someone comes along who's completely amateur and they wow everyone. And
yep.
It's all everyone talks about for the next 3 weeks.
Yeah. Where I thought you were going when you're saying I want to see more amateur sports in the Olympics, I was like, yeah, let's get rid of it. So if you, apart from maybe, you know, the athletics and the swimming, because they're so important to what the Olympics actually is, if you can make a living from your sport, perhaps it shouldn't be an Olympic sport.
Yeah.
I think there's a much better argument for roller derby in the Olympics.
Than oh, yes. Cricket. I would love to see roller derby.
That would be amazing. And, what other sports have you got? You've got that, there's that outdoor field. There's the ice field hockey game as well that you could play in the Winter Olympics, where you freeze over a regular hockey pitch and play on that. It's got a whole lot of different rules than ice hockey. It's like European handball. That's although I think you can actually make a
living. No, you can make quite a lot of money. You can make quite a good living playing
like,
Europe.
It's like hockey as well. Like, yeah. it's if you're on the Australian hockey team, you're probably making decent money playing hockey in Europe and stuff. So there probably really isn't that many non-professional sports at an elite level.
No. We're just waiting for more sports to get invented. And
yeah, maybe start inventing some sports. And I thought there's korfball. Why can't we have I actually think korfball might have been in the Olympics in 1924.
Haven't heard of korfball.
It's kind of like a cross between. It's sort of like half basketball, half netball.
Okay.
So there's more movement involved, but no backboard and. I don't know. I've spoken about that in some podcast at some point. Definitely had a conversation about korfball. Big in Holland, I think, something like that, or Denmark. Yeah.
And who knows? Maybe one day we'll see cricket.
Yeah, I don't know about cricket. Now we've got T20. Like T20.
Yeah. The T20 is the perfect format.
Would work. And given how much, I don't know, given. It would probably be nice, actually, because they'd probably open it up to 32 teams.
Yeah.
And we'd start to see some, so the associate nations would start getting some competitions that would be worth, some big competitions to get some exposure, not like this ridiculous 10-team World Cup.
10-team, 45-game World Cup that's been bloody boring.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I see a good point in everyone playing everyone.
No.
Like that, there is something to that, but only 3 knockout games, really.
No.
Anyway, that's again probably a conversation for another podcast, and probably worth wrapping it up there for this week. Sipun, thanks again for being here.
No worries, Ant.
In the pod box of dreams, and thanks everyone for listening. Tweet at me at Ant Condon, email me anthony@anthonycondon.com. Go check out the website. Feedback is great. This is for a thesis. I'm going to write stuff about the feedback at some point, so love to get it. But that's all for now. Thank you and goodbye.
Cricket, cricket, all the way. We got it deep in our DNA. So when they start to play and you want to know,
bloody ball.
The main of every true blue fan is the bad ex-cricketer anchorman. It's the same old words in the same old voice. Long past time there was another choice, like the white line wireless.
White line wireless.
White line wireless.
White line wireless.
From the box of dreams you're gonna hear the call.
Oh, bob, bloody ball.